Coming up on Tech News Weekly, it's me, Jason Howell, my co-host Micah Sargent, and a whole lot of show, starting with Jaypreet Verdi, author of Hearing Happiness, Deafness Cures in History. She actually talks about the hidden consequences in this move to over-the-counter hearing aids. Fascinating perspectives. Also, Mark Gurman from Bloomberg actually spills the beans on all of the hardware coming from Apple. It's right around the corner. Still a rumored September event, but we know it's going to happen. He's got the details there. I take a look at two reports that shed light on the current state of broadcasting cable TV. And spoiler alert, streaming is hitting some major milestones in that race. And finally, Micah sheds light on how iOS VPNs have been failing to protect its users because of a single missing line of code. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 248, recorded Thursday, August 18th, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Dell Client Solutions Devices, orchestrated by the experts at CDW, which deliver a more personalized user experience with adaptive AI-based software that boosts collaboration wherever your team works. Learn more at cdw.com/dellclient.
And by Unify Meeting from MIMO Monitors. Unify simplifies your work life by combining your favorite video conferencing solutions into one reliable, universal user interface. Visit unifymeeting.com and enter the code TNW for 25% off of a year's subscription, or use the same code to get 25% off any of MIMO's 7-inch displays.
And by IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla. IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. Hosted by Bridget Todd, this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Search for IRL in your podcast player.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And I'm the other guy, Jason Howell. Good to see you, Micah. We've got a show today. I am so pumped for this first interview. I'm so happy we could pull this off. So yes. Why don't we just get right into it? Because this is big news. A new FDA ruling paves the way for over-the-counter hearing aids to be sold, which means that people won't need a prescription to buy them anymore, right? And while that sounds very liberating, there are actually some downsides to consider. And joining us to talk through these pitfalls is Jaypreet Verdi, assistant professor at University of Delaware and author of the book Hearing Happiness, Deafness Cures in History. Welcome to the show, Jaypreet.
Hello, very happy to be here and have a conversation about this.
Absolutely. This is an important conversation. We love, I personally love this show for the very reason that we get to do interviews like this. This is about expanding kind of understanding about aspects of technology that some people might not even be too familiar with. And you wrote a cautionary article for Wired. Before we get to that, let's first talk a little bit about the current state of hearing aids. Start by sharing your own history with hearing loss and hearing aids. It sounds like you spent, over the years, you spent quite a lot of money on hearing aids.
I have. To be frank, my parents probably spent a lot more than I have because I became deaf at age 4 when my hearing was damaged from meningitis. And by 6, I received my first pair of hearing aids, which would be the first of many that I would have over my lifetime. Now, as a child living in Canada, the costs of these were covered by health insurance, and this included costs for regular testing, batteries, maintenance, and repair. But by the time I was an adult, costs were subsidized partly by insurance, so I had to pay out of pocket for approximately half the cost of the hearing aid. And this meant that I spent maybe $5,000 to nearly $9,000 per pair over my adult life in Canada and the United States. And that's not even including costs associated with regular exam, maintenance, batteries, upgrades, etc.
Wow. Okay. So that really adds up. What exactly is it about hearing aids that makes them so incredibly expensive?
That's a great question. You know, there's several factors to this, both historical and political. I mean, historically, prices were set by the hearing aid industry, which for most of the 20th century were dominated by four companies, and they placed immense retail markup for their product. So one source that I uncovered when I was writing my book was that in the 1970s, the manufacturing cost for a hearing aid was between $15 to $35, but it was marked up at a retail cost of $200 to $600. And these are the kind of price differences that still continue today, where sometimes the markup cost is up to 175% the actual manufacturing cost. And there are other contemporary factors at play as well. Most hearing aids are included in what's termed as a bundled services model. And these are costs included not just for the technology itself, but for associated professional services. So hearing aid testing, fittings, as well as maintenance and repair under warranty. And not to mention that hearing aid companies explain that the high price of their products include the cost of research and development to create better technology and innovative features for future products. And then there's the essential reason for this high cost as well, is that in the United States, hearing aids are not covered by insurance.
Right. Yeah. And you write about that. Specifically, you also write that Medicare doesn't cover hearing aids. Yet this seems like such an essential product for someone's, you know, normal, natural lifetime. Like, why is it that they aren't covered by insurance largely?
That's because hearing aids are classified as a consumer product, not as an essential medical device. So when Medicare was enacted in 1965, hearing aids were actually excluded from the list of devices to be covered, even though numerous studies in the 1950s and 1960s indicated that elderly people were the most vulnerable demographic for hearing aids, but they often avoided purchasing them because of their high cost, the complex navigation through the medical system, as well as this kind of stigma against wearing hearing aids.
Yes, and you write a lot about this the stigma that's associated with this, and we'll talk about that for sure. But what I want to kind of go over first here is kind of segue into where we're at right now, this over-the-counter solution for hearing aids. This would arguably lead to less expensive devices, right? Which on its surface sounds like a really great thing considering the high cost that you're talking about here. But you caution in your piece for Wired that this has unintended consequences. What are those?
Well, for one thing, over-the-counter hearing aids are still going to be marketed as a consumer product. That means, again, without being framed as an essential medical device, they will not be covered by insurance. And even if they're a lower price, like, say, $600, there's still going to be people who need them and can't afford them. But there's also a broader consequence as well, in that over-the-counter hearing aids complicate how hearing loss is actually understood. You can't just go to a store and pick up a hearing aid and expect that it will just restore your hearing. For most people with mild and moderate hearing loss, it might provide some benefit, but you're still going to need individualized fitting. You need the device to target your specific loss in the frequency range, and that one that would improve your sound limits and your speech comprehension. So without getting this full benefits of hearing aids, there's a risk that your hearing will continue to decline, and you're still going to need proper hearing health care, not just the technology. There's one person on Twitter, their name is Jules Good, described that it's like getting a complex Lego set with no instructions.
Right. Yeah. I can imagine getting this consumer device comes, you know, maybe with a little paper manual on the inside that gives you some sort of sense of how to use it. But I think your point is incredibly valid, right? There's so much more to this device than just like a hi-fi stereo that you plug into the wall.
Exactly.
You know, it's kind of shameful that a device like this isn't considered a medical device, because, I mean, it's treated like one in one fast in one way, but then not at all in another. That's really frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is, like, how even will a consumer choose? you can't expect people to just test their hearing and understand how to connect what they're reading in those tests with the type of model that they're going to buy. And some over-the-counter hearing aids are actually being sold with, or going to be sold with, associated app that you can figure out the best model for your hearing loss. But I think this is something that audiologists have spent their entire career training for. And this is the kind of a skillful professional service that should be provided rather than just continuing this model of hearing aids as simply consumer product, because then you kind of eliminate the medical services that are essential for having good hearing health.
Yes, indeed. Now, you mentioned just a few minutes ago the stigma that's attached to hearing aids. And this was this was something that I had never really considered before reading your piece. You make the point that marketing these over-the-counter hearing aids as invisible actually creates a dangerous binary. I thought this was fascinating. Tell us a little bit about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, the binary I refer to in the article is the presumption that deafness falls in one or two categories, that you are hard of hearing and wear hearing aids, or you are culturally deaf and communicate with sign language or wear cochlear implants. This binary actually diminishes the range of auditory spectrum and experiences that a lot of deaf people have, and that actually doesn't fall in either one of these categories. So for instance, I have 98% hearing loss, which puts me in the category of being profoundly deaf and a candidate for a cochlear implant. But I actually grew up wearing hearing aids and adapting to the world this way, and learned to communicate with lip reading, or even as we're doing here for this virtual talk, behind the scenes, there's actually closed captioning on the screen that is helping me understand what you are saying. So this consistent marketing of hearing devices as invincible further propagates a stigma against deafness, in that it's something to be embarrassed or ashamed of, even if you're wearing this like super awesome technology to aid your experience in the world. So in other words, continue to push hearing devices as invincible, or like highlighting that feature of invincibility, diminishes deaf pride. Like, it makes deafness something to be hidden or eliminated.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you point that out and brought that to my awareness. That's just not anything that I've ever been aware of before. So I appreciate knowing that. So considering all of this, and considering that you are a person that would stand to benefit from improvements in this industry, mm-hmm. what are your recommendations here? Is it that over-the-counter hearing aids shouldn't happen, or is there a better way for this to happen?
Well, we need to understand that deafness, or even like hard of hearing, is not a one-size-fits-all approach. Someone actually wrote to me in response to my Wired article saying that I can't possibly have 98% hearing loss, because if I did, no hearing aid on the market would help me, only cochlear implant. Well, I actually found a model to help me, but this letter actually reflects this problem people have in perceiving deafness. And I think that without having deaf people in the room where tech is being designed, so either deaf people working as designers, consultants, or users, then we can actually figure out what features of these technologies will best aid in navigating through a hearing world. So having deaf people in the room where decisions are made, when designs are coming together, would actually, I think, increase the broader cultural understanding of how hearing loss is actually experienced.
It's fascinating. Well, Jaypreet, I really appreciate you taking some time to talk with us and to share your perspective on this on the podcast. I love that we were able to work with the technology to make this happen. And you are so wonderful. You are the author of the book, Hearing Happiness, Deafness Cures in History. If people want to find you online, where can they find you?
I'm on Twitter at JayVirdi, JAIVIDI.
Awesome. Jaypreet, thank you so much, and best of luck going forward. And
have a good day.
I'm curious
Goodbye.
To see how this develops. Take care. Coming up, rumors, they are adrift, actually, that Apple's next iPhone event might actually be around the corner, which isn't that much of a surprise. Usually it happens in September, but what do we know about that event? That's coming up next. We're going to have Mark Gurman from Bloomberg on to talk about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Dell. client solutions devices orchestrated by the experts at CDW. The people at CDW get that your unique workforce has unique needs for their devices, of course, especially as we all continue with this hybrid work environment that we're locked in these days. It's a challenge for IT to supply devices that can meet everyone's needs. And also everywhere they work so that they can stay connected throughout the day. Well, luckily, CDW can help custom configure Dell client solutions devices for a more personalized user experience. And what this means, basically, is that your workforce gets adaptability for performance with AI-based software that actually learns how your team works and optimizes workflows. And then check this out. Dell client solutions devices have intelligent noise detection and cancellation along with high quality video that adjusts your lighting. Pretty darn amazing. I love where technology is headed. This fleet of devices is really great because wherever your team works, its built-in security responds to malicious attacks, providing a secure way to boost collaboration and productivity from anywhere. So when it comes to seamless experiences, Dell Systems makes adaptive performance possible. CDW makes it powerful. Learn more at cdw.com/Dell Client. That's cdw.com/Dell Client. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly.
All right. Apple's event is just around the corner. Well, we're hearing anyway. And with that comes a whole host of new devices and kind of kicking off the next iteration of Apple's most popular and often most earningest. Yes, earningest. We'll go with that. Devices. Joining us today to talk about all things rumor and perhaps fact is Mark Gurman of Bloomberg. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Hey, Micah, thanks for having me. Let's call it fact, right? I know we have to call them rumors, but it's as factual as you're going to get ahead of time.
Absolutely. That is one of the things that I very much appreciate about the work that you specifically do is I always feel comfortable bringing you on the show to talk about this stuff because you tend to make sure that, things are as they claim to be heading into the event and that, you know, you're very clear about when something is that things could change, et cetera, et cetera. So with this event coming up, I think the first question that everybody will have is what day is the event likely to take place? Apple's iPhone event. What date are we thinking about looking at? And then as a little aside, is this a live event or is this a pre-recorded one?
So the event will be on Wednesday, September 7th. Now, why that's interesting is that this is a little bit earlier than usual. It's about a week earlier than usual than they normally would do. The other thing is that typically these events are on Tuesdays. This one will be on a Wednesday. Now, why Wednesday? Well, September 5th in the U.S. is obviously Labor Day, right? So you want to put that travel day in that Tuesday. Now, I think that answers your second question. Why do you need a travel day? Well, my expectation is that media will be invited to the event on that September 7th, that Wednesday, for a hands-on afterwards. It will be an online streamed type of showcase like they've done over the past 2.5 years or so. But there'll be a stream of that, just like they did with WWDC in June. So I don't think it's going to be any different. Looking forward to, you know, that announcement. And I would assume I won't be there. Let's see if something changes. But I think that it's going to be pretty jam-packed. You'll see the iPhone 14 line. You can see it on the screen, what we're talking about there for my story. You'll also see the Apple Watch Series 8. So that's going to be three models. And then I'm expecting a second event in October for new Macs as well as new iPads. So pretty packed fall.
Wow. Yeah. This is a very packed fall. So let's start then with the iPhone. What have the rumors kind of been thus far? And what are we looking at for the next iteration of Apple's, as I said, earningest device?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from everything that I've been told and I've heard, no surprises, right? So you're going to see four new models, the big change is going to be actually on the Pro phone. So on the Pro phone, you'll see the notch be replaced, as you've seen the renderings, with a pill-shaped cutout for Face ID, a hole punch shape cutout for the front-facing camera. And then you're also going to see slimmer bezels around the sides of the phone, so a little bit of an updated look. 48-megapixel camera on the back, new processor on the Pro. The big story with the regular phones, the regular iPhone 14, will be that slight price increase. That's because they're replacing the iPhone Mini with an iPhone Max. So you'll see an iPhone 14 Max for the first time. That's a 6.7-inch phone. That's going to be pretty enticing, I think, for a lot of people, getting that really big screen size without having to pay the Pro penny for it.
Wow. So you're saying that there won't be a small phone. Is that correct?
No small phone. So they had the phone, the mini phones for the 12 and the 13. Not as many people as they thought were buying them. They think more people are actually going to want a bigger size now. So you're going between small and big. Everything was once small, everything now big, and you go vice versa. I bet you would drink that in 3 years they're going to go the other direction again, right? So 2022.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wouldn't be surprised if it does pivot again the other way as people think about going the other route. But it is cool that then we have that kind of larger phone without needing to upgrade to the Pro. The camera update obviously is big for both devices. One of the things that I read in your piece and that we have kind of heard for quite a while now is that the chip inside of the next non-Pro iPhone is going to be the same as the chip that is in the iPhone 13. Can you talk a little bit about that and sort of how you think Apple, because this is what's always fascinating to me. How will Apple talk about this at the event? Are they just going to come out and say, yeah, we put the same chip in it and it's just better because you got a better camera? Are they not going to mention that? Are they going to, how will they handle that, do you think?
So my personal thought, so when it comes to the iPhone 14 Pro, they'll talk about how it has this new A16 chip that's X percent faster and better in XYZ ways than the A15 chip. When it comes to announcing the iPhone 14, they'll simply say the iPhone 14 has the A15 chip, and they won't go much further than that. They won't get into the why or that it's the same as last year or this is the first time ever they haven't put a new chip in a new iPhone, right? They'll ignore all that, and they'll let that play out in the press and amongst consumers. They won't get into it. Now, I think your question is, why are they doing this? Well, so there's three extremely pricey parts in the phone, right? External casing, the screen, and the chip. Those are the top three most expensive parts in a phone. And given that costs for production, costs for shipping and freight, inflation, everything is going on and raising prices, you have to cut corners somewhere, right? And I think they decided that cutting corners on the chip upgrade, given the A15 is pretty good already, I think that's really the only place they could have made that change in order to not raise prices even more than they may already be planning to. So I think that's what it was. Also, resource placement. The Mac chips take a lot of resources, right? Getting the chips ready for the VR headset next year, a lot of resources. So you're not seeing big increases this year on the chips because the resources are in other places. The Apple Car chip that they're working on as well, right? So I think there's all sorts of rationale for why the iPhone 14 is sticking with the A15 chip. I think it's pretty significant, but I don't think it's the end of the world either.
Now, you may or may not be surprised based on your own experience. How many people from my past, including a couple of high school teachers, have reached out to me over the past couple of months asking me for my advice on when to upgrade to the next iPhone and when the new right, and when the new iPhone is coming out? So let all of our listeners know.
It's always September. So, you know, the thing to me is everyone always asks me every year, when's the new iPhone coming? When's the new iPhone coming out? Literally September. You know, 90% of the time, right? So, like, don't ask me anymore, right? But September 16th, Apple retail employees are prepared for a big launch on the 16th. Would expect at least some of the watches to come a little bit later, though. So stay tuned for more.
Yeah. So now, yeah, let's pivot to the Apple Watch, because this is the other thing that you suggest will be at this specific event announced there. We had talked previously about rumors and, you know, stuff that you had heard about the next Apple Watch. So if you could just sort of give our listeners a quick rundown of what you know about the next versions of the Apple Watch, what they can expect to see at this event and perhaps later this fall.
So I'm going to break this down as cleanly as I can because I've had a little bit of practice on talking about these Apple Watches because we've talked about them so long. Okay, first time, three distinct models. A new Apple Watch SE, an Apple Watch Series 8, and an Apple Watch Pro. Apple Watch SE last launched 2 years ago, 2020. It's going to look the same and operate the same as that version, but it's going to have a faster processor that's on par with the chip in the other two new Apple Watch models. So that's the SE. Flagship watch, the Apple Watch Series 8. That's going to look like the Series 7. Two major changes. One, new women's health features. Two, body temperature sensor. Should be able to tell you if you have a fever or something else going on. Three, most significant watch, the Apple Watch Pro. That's going to have a new design. It's going to be a redesigned watch. First redesigned since the Series 4 back in 2018. Going to have a larger display, a rugged titanium casing, a much stronger sapphire cover on the display. Same processor, same sensors as the Apple Watch Series 8. New look, new bands. I think that's going to be quite significant. Also, it's going to be quite expensive.
Okay. And that the expense comes in because of the casing and the new sapphire on the front?
Yeah, so it really is the casing that's really driving up the cost of the Apple Watch Pro. I think the screen size increase is incremental over the Series 8. It's about 7% more screen area, so you're not going to get a lot more cost there. So to your point, it is the combination of that casing as well as the new cover. So the new cover is quite a bit stronger, right? You know how many people I've known that have accidentally knocked their Apple Watch into a door handle or something else and just cracked that thing?
Oh.
That's going to be less prone to that. But now, your great question on the casing. So the casing is going to be some formulation of titanium, right? And that is traditionally more expensive. Now, right now, they have the Apple Watch Edition in titanium there. I believe that costs $850 for the smaller variation, right, of the Apple Watch Series 7. So you're going to see that probably come in at least $50 to $150 more expensive. I think the Apple Watch Pro is going to go north of $900. So I would say it's going to cost between $900 and $1,000. I'm also told that it's going to be polarizing in the fact that it's not going to fit most people's wrists. So some people may find that the Apple Watch Pro is simply too big on their wrist and they're not going to want that model. I also believe it's only going to come in one screen size. So whereas on the Series 7, you have the 41 and the 45 millimeter configs, this is going to be on the larger side. So probably 46 to 48 millimeters in size for the display. With that additional screen area, you'll see new watch faces, you'll see new fitness features specific to the Apple Watch Pro. Quite exciting.
Holy moly. Yeah, that sounds very pricey, but I suppose if you have these prices now that are a shock, then whenever that headset comes out sometime in the next few years, that when we see the price of that, it won't be as much of a shock. It's like, oh, we're already spending $1,000 on Apple Watches. This is no big deal.
So there is one more feature of WatchOS 9 that hasn't launched yet or been announced, and that is a low power mode. And the low power mode, since the original Apple Watch, as you know, and your viewers surely know, you can put it in a very low power reserve mode so it can show the time in sort of that green text floating around a watch, but you can't do anything else. Whereas on the iPhone and the iPad and the Mac now, I believe, the low power mode lets you completely operate every feature or many of the features of your devices in a lower power state. So everything slows down a bit and it extends battery life. They'll be bringing that to the Apple Watch with WatchOS 9. So look out for that. Now, the second thing is on the Apple Watch Pro, you're going to get a bigger battery. So you're going to get longer battery life. And combining the bigger battery, right, with the low power mode, you might be getting into pretty decent territory on battery life on the Apple Watch for the first time. Now, the thing that Apple has to look out for is that Samsung just launched their new Pro Watch 5 line. That has, I believe, upwards of 80 hours of battery life. And it's probably going to cost half of what the Apple Watch Pro is going to cost. So that is another pretty enticing watch. And they're also coming up against the Google Pixel Watch this fall. Now, the Google Pixel Watch looks pretty cool, right? I like that circular design. It is pretty nifty. I think it's not going to do so well, though.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to see on that one for sure. But the extended battery life is a cool idea, especially for folks who like to wear their Apple Watch for sleep tracking features. Mark Gurman, thank you so much for your time today and for especially that nice little rundown of the Apple Watch there at the end. Of course, we'll be keeping our eyes out on the event as it takes place likely on September 7th. But if folks want to follow your work and check you out online, where should they go to do so?
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. It's always so fun to have to be on here and talk to you, Micah. Have me on as much as you want. I'm sure we'll talk again after the event. Bloomberg.com/power on for my column. You'll get all the insights you're looking for there. Twitter.com/Mark Gurman. And I appreciate everyone tuning in and reading along with me.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Mark. All right, folks, it is time. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Unify Meeting from MIMO Monitors, the global experts in video conferencing solutions. So think about the struggle of using all sorts of different video conferencing platforms. You've got Zoom, you've got Google Meet, you've got Microsoft Teams, and especially now that we're living in this kind of hybrid world, or maybe you just are completely remote, well, combining all of those solutions together, all those video conferencing solutions together, sounds like a good idea. Well, that is where Unify Meeting comes into place, because it will create one reliable, universal user interface. It's the intuitive software solution to simplify your work life by combining all your favorite video conferencing solutions into that one spot. So it eliminates the hassle and saves you time. We're all spending more time on video calls than we ever have before. I mean, we're doing it right now. And figuring out where to click on a screen or which video conferencing platform in a meeting you're supposed to use, it can be a real struggle. In fact, my pal and lead host on the network, Leo Laporte, has talked before about how in Google Meet meetings, he goes to unmute his microphone and accidentally hits hang up. And he said, I can remember him saying, you can ask other people to confirm if this is true. I'm confirming it's true all the time. He's hopping into a meeting and it's disappearing all of a sudden because he's hit the wrong button. So that is where something like Unify Meeting could come into work and help make it easier. Unify eliminates the frustration. It takes the guesswork out of things. It's reliable every time, as the buttons and commands are always in the same place. It doesn't matter if you're using Zoom, Microsoft Teams, or Google Meet. Whether you're working full-time in the office or remotely, hybrid, Unify keeps your video conferencing simple and intuitive. You can navigate between all your meetings easily without worrying about needing to keep track of changing video conferencing apps or changing commands. It's always on your desktop, but it's never in the way. Unify Meeting displays your calendar at all times, which is very handy, making it simple to see daily schedules and upcoming meetings. Then, when it's time for a meeting, you just tap the calendar invite and the app opens the video conferencing call in its standardized UI format. There's no more needing to manually open up your video conferencing software or even know which one your meeting is in, which can be such a hassle trying to figure out, oh, am I supposed to go here? Unify works best on a second or third display, taking up minimal desk real estate, but still providing you with enhanced convenience. And for added accessibility, you can still see the video conferencing application's original UI on your primary screen. So if there's a button you like to hit in Zoom, well, it'll still be there for you. It's the best of both worlds. Unify runs on Windows, it's PC compatible, and it only costs $35.88 for the entire year. And with a purchase of any MIMO monitors display, it's free. So you could just get the MIMO monitors display and get Unify Meeting included. Super cool. So try Unify for your team at work or try it for yourself. Visit unifymeeting.com. That's unifymeeting.com and enter the code TNW to get 25% off of a year's subscription. Or you can use that same code to get 25% off any of MIMO's 7-inch displays. Simplify with Unify. Ooh, I love that. Simplify with Unify. We thank Unify Meeting for their support of this show. All right, we are back from the break, and that means it's time for Jason Howell's Story of the Week. I just saw the
Sato
fly into the air.
S-O-T-W, Sato. It's time for the Sato.
I don't know. I think we need to rebrand that. I don't think that works. That doesn't fly off the tongue. Not at least like your floating titles do for our Story of the Week. Anyways, streaming hit another milestone, and I thought it was worth at least shedding some light on. There's a lot of numbers here, but I think it's very interesting to see where we're at. I'm not really that surprised about some of these numbers, but there's a few different reports that we can talk about. Nielsen has some data from last month, so this is July 2022, and in that report, it shows that more U.S. viewers are actually watching streaming services than either cable or broadcast, and this is how the numbers break down. Broadcast has about 21.6% viewership, cable 34.4%, streaming 34.8%. So it's not really that surprising that streaming actually surpassed broadcast. That had already happened in the past, but it's this passing of cable that's the first time it's happened. This is the first time that streaming's actually passed cable, even if that's only 0.4%. There's still a first for everything, and here we are. It is important to note that because this is Nielsen, after all, Nielsen data only really includes content on TVs, you know, so that's regular TVs, internet-connected TVs. A lot of times this is self-reported, but still locked into the TV experience. This doesn't factor in mobile or web streaming. If it did, these numbers would be clearly off the charts, you know, by comparison. I'm sure that's another report for another day, but still very interesting as far as like the habits and everything that's happening inside the living room. Cable and broadcast, if you kind of, you know, lump these together, because they're kind of similar beasts from the same bucket, right? They still account for more than streaming as a whole. But I think what's really interesting, we've, you know, talked about this on the network a lot recently, is that live sports is starting to make its way from a cable or broadcast only realm, like NFL, you know, Amazon has their Thursday night football that they've had for a little while, but now they've got to deal with Nielsen. And then, you know, everybody's vying for the rights for the Sunday ticket. And that's, you know, probably going to go away from DirecTV, almost certainly going away from DirecTV and into the hands of someone like Apple, that sort of stuff. So when you take a look at these numbers and then you think about live sports being this kind of like traditional draw for live broadcast experience and cable experience, now suddenly that's coming to streaming as well. So you can only imagine that these numbers are going to shift even further. Does any of this surprise you at this point, Micah?
No. I think that you had a populate. Okay, so this will get a little grim for a second, but I think that it does play a role, unfortunately. We suffered a pandemic and, well, kind of continue to suffer a pandemic. And it largely affected populations that are more at risk of dying from respiratory illness. And in many cases, that means that the elderly were the ones at risk of dying from these illnesses. And that in general, young people were less likely to have died from the illness. And at the same time, the time keeps marching forward and, you know, generations continue to age out. And we have for a long time, I think, put more focus on it. Like, it's almost not even, we're coming to a place where cutting the cord is not the thing. It's like, it flips, and it's instead of people who are cutting the cord, it's like people who still have the cord are the people that are the kind of outlier in the group, and that not having a cord in the first place is the standard. So I guess connecting the cord is going to become the group that we talk about. I think that as a whole, a lot of people are just streaming and viewing, you know, YouTube or whatever it is that they do, and that the population who happily paid that monthly fee to their cable company, you know, shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And, you know, I could even go as far as to say that there are certain populations of folks who are very into cable news and who fall into certain predetermined buckets where they are maybe less likely to be concerned about precautionary measurements related to pandemics and things like that. And all of this is to say, I'm not surprised, because there are a number of factors that are playing into the group of people who are watching stuff over cable shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
You brought up a really good point. That's a great segue into one of the other studies here. Ofcom had their annual Media Nations report, and it creates a little bit more context around the current state of streaming and broadcast, kind of like the ages of where people are at and behaviors around age. This report is in the UK by comparison. The Nielsen report focused on the US. 16 to 24-year-olds spend only 53 minutes per day watching broadcast TV, which is actually a two-thirds drop over the past 10 years. So that doesn't surprise me a whole lot, you know, that they're the that's the age range that would latch to whatever the new, you know, thing is. And over the last 10 years, it has been streaming largely. So obviously they're going to be going all in on that. Where, and this is the part that kind of ties in with that, I was able to draw a connection based on what you were just saying about kind of the pandemic impact and how the pandemic, you know, really impacted the older population pretty dramatically. Broadcast and cable really shine in that 65 and older category, slightly less than 6 hours per day on average. People 65 and older watching 6 hours per day. And I guess the connection that I made based on what you were saying was, I wonder if that's actually gone up, considering that the pandemic over the past couple of years has actually meant more people isolated at home, just trying to, you know, pass the time. And I, you know, I can only attest from my own, you know, completely subjective data point, which is my parents. They watch more TV now than they ever have, that I know of. And I don't know if that's a direct impact of the pandemic, or that they're just, you know, in that older age category. So they're part of, you know, would share these numbers with a lot of other people in that same category. I'm not sure, but I bet you there's some sort of correlation there. I would have a hunch that, you know, once the pandemic happened, that number of total hours spent for that age category probably jumped up. And I think that's a pretty solid reason why. That's interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense too. That you would still see that increase for that group. Even if that group is shrinking, the ones that are still in that group are watching more, because I mean, certainly I have watched more Netflix or Hulu or whatever than I have in the past, due to the fact that, you know, most of the time is spent at home, or, you know, some level of staying in. So
makes
sense.
It's so interesting when I look at my own behavior, because I don't know if my viewing went up dramatically in the pandemic. Like, I feel like my viewing has actually gone down. I feel like I've been so busy in other aspects of my life that I haven't had time for viewing of much anything. I don't know how that relates to this, but I guess everybody's habits are different. But the Ofcom report does show a shift in how households are subscribing to services, because we know, you know, Netflix is kind of at for the first time at the point where they're like, okay, what the heck is going on? Netflix, by the way, still doing okay based going back to Nielsen. They sit at 7.7% total share of TV consumption. YouTube is the only one that's even close, 7.3%. And then everyone else is much further behind, 3%, you know, 1.8% for Disney Plus and everything like that. But the Ofcom report showed a significant drop in homes who reported subscribing to at least one service. And they blame that on the tightening budgets, you know, over the last couple of years, things, and especially this year, things have really tightened up. Though three quarters of those in the report did say that they plan to sign back up again when things improve. Obviously, that is a flexibility and a benefit that consumers enjoy. The services not so much, right? Even though that's part of the appeal, but I think it kind of shows, you know, another aspect of why Netflix is facing the challenges that it is right now. As the economy gets worse, people tend to, you know, look at the things that they can shave off, and especially when you've got these services like Netflix that have these marquee shows that you can just drop in, get them all, you know, in a month.
That precisely is what. Yeah, I was going to, if you hadn't brought it up, I was going to say we can't discount the behavior of get it, you know, waiting for your show to come on, getting it during that month and then leaving. That is a common behavior that folks have. So it's
absolutely
not. I think that has to be accounted for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And then I won't get into much else, but I did find this interesting. The Ofcom report also shed some light on short form video as well. And, you know, there's some interesting stuff there as far as like the amount, you know, of viewers, the age of viewers for things like Shorts and Instagram, TikTok, whatever. But I found this data point kind of interesting. The most viewed category of short form video is DIY content, how-to content. So that just tells me, if that's true, if you are an aspiring TikToker or whatever, get on the how-to train. That's where you're going to find you know, the gold that you can reap from that.
Choo-choo.
So. Yeah. Interesting.
Cool.
Anyways, I find those things kind of fascinating, especially with something that for decades upon decades has been so locked into the broadcast model. And cable, satellite kind of came along and disrupted that to a certain degree, but streaming has really shaken the foundation of everything that anyone, you know, thought was just set in stone forever. And we're in the midst of that right now. So we'll see where it all lands. When we return to the show, we're not really going anywhere, but we're going to come back after this little break. And Micah's going to talk about when a VPN might not actually be a VPN, because researchers are saying iOS might be that in that situation. So I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on this, Micah. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IRL. That's an original podcast from Mozilla. IRL is a show for people who build AI. If you're fascinated with AI like I am, you're going to love this. Also, people who develop tech policies, because there needs to be a lot of really solid policy placed around the development of AI. So it's really important. Hosted by Bridget Todd, this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. So who does AI have the power to help? Who can it actually harm? All those kinds of things. The show features fascinating conversations with people who are working to build more trustworthy AI. And I've checked out a few of these episodes. They're fascinating. Well worth checking out. For example, there's an episode about how our world is mapped with AI. Some of that, you know, we're just kind of benefiting from, and we don't even realize that AI is at the heart of that. The data that's missing from these maps actually also tells as much of a story as the maps themselves. And you actually hear all about the people who are working to fill in those gaps, take control of the data. There's an episode about gig workers who depend on apps for their livelihood. It looks at how they're pushing back against algorithms that control how much they get paid, seeking new ways to gain power over data to create better working conditions. I appreciated how this episode really showed kind of how disparate and broken things are behind the scenes in these gig working companies and how that impacts the workforce. And does AI actually have the power to fix that? That's always the big question, right? And then for political junkies, there are episodes about the role that AI plays when it comes to the spread of misinformation and hate speech around elections, which we have, you know, coming up here in the US, a huge concern for democracies all around the world, not just here. So search for IRL in your podcast player. We're going to include a link in the show notes. So take a look for that. And we thank IRL for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, Micah, your story of the week time. Tell us about VPNs.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting story that I had no idea about this. According to the researcher, the computer researcher, Michael Horowitz, it's been 2 years since there has been some understanding that VPNs don't work as they are supposed to or are intended to on iOS. And It's important to understand, of course, how VPNs work in the first place. I know a lot of our listeners are well aware of how these systems work, but for anyone who doesn't, a VPN, it stands for Virtual Private Network, and it gives you the ability to mask your behavior to an extent online. So typically, when I go online and I type in, you know, a website, twitter.com, my specific computer is connected to my router, which is connected to the modem. And I go to twitter.com, and then my house has an IP that is tied to the modem and my account with Xfinity. So let's just say my IP, which this is obviously not a real one, 1.1.1.1. So I, you know, go to a website and my system sends out its desire to go to twitter.com and connect to Twitter. And it goes over Xfinity and kind of pulls that information in from the Twitter website, and I'm able to see it then on my computer. Well, my internet service provider, my ISP, can see my behavior there, can see that I am going to twitter.com. And of course, there are little caveats, because if both sides of it are HTTPS versus HTTP, then there's something involved with that as well. But just we're kind of laying the base here. If I were to activate a VPN, a virtual private network, what would happen is when I type in twitter.com, my computer or my phone, if I'm using that, will, instead of going directly to Twitter and then Twitter pulling down the information to my system, it will go to this VPN. And then the VPN, this virtual private network, will go and connect to Twitter and then pull it back in and then feed that information to me. So what happens is, and all of this is encrypted, and so instead of your ISP being able to see kind of where you're going, it's only ever the communication looks like it's only ever happening kind of this one way between you and the virtual private network. And so that exchange that takes place is more private. And the reason that they suggest using VPNs whenever you are connecting to a public network, like a hotel Wi-Fi, is for that same reason, where if you're making direct connections to different sites, then there's a lot more information that a nefarious, a bad actor, as we say, on the network would be able to figure out what you're doing and potentially pull information from you. But by using a virtual private network, then all of that information is masked through the use of that VPN. So what is meant to happen is, the moment I turn on my VPN, I use ExpressVPN. They are a sponsor of the network. I've used them for a long time, and it's a great VPN. When I turn on a VPN, then all of the connections that I currently have. So right now, there's a connection that I have with Zoom because we're doing this Zoom meeting. And there's a connection that I have with Google because I've got my docs open for the show. There's a connection that I have with the Ars Technica website and all sorts of other things. Slack, basically everything that I'm connected to on my computer is all connected through this normal means without a VPN turned on. If I turn on a VPN, the expectation is that everything will close off. Those current connections will close off, and that everything will then be routed through the VPN, as opposed to being routed how it is right now, just directly to these different services. And that is how you are protected. Because if you have a system where you are, let's say you are a political figure who is working to circumvent the dictatorial leadership of another country, and you need to be able to communicate with your team in a way that can't be scooped or seen by other people. So you have a VPN, you turn that VPN on, now all of that stuff is supposed to be happening within the system where your IP is then masked and everything is protected. What you don't want is to have that VPN turn on and the systems that you're using actively are tunneled now through the VPN, but some of your other systems and services are still going through the normal means. When I turn on a VPN, I want everything to go through this system. And that is what this story is about. And hold on, I'm just... Yeah, no. Scooter X has just sent me a link in the chat talking about how Apple has fixed this, but that this is not, this is actually included in the story. So, okay. I wanted to make sure that something hadn't happened between me learning about this morning and more. This is an ongoing concern. Apple said that they fixed this in iOS 14, but not only did Michael Horowitz not see a fix, Proton VPN also continued to not see a fix. So rolling it back a little bit, that is how I'm expected to be able to use a VPN. Everything gets routed through that tunnel as soon as I turn it on. So now I can explain this story. Michael Horowitz says since 2018, it has been the case that when you turn on your VPN on iOS, some of the connections do not get routed through the VPN. They keep those connections open and routed through your normal connection outside of the VPN. And Proton VPN it looks like one of the first to spot this. The vulnerability, it says, quote, started at least in iOS 13.3.1. And most of the connections that are routed through the tunnel were fine and dandy, but some of the connections that weren't routed through, even after you turned on the VPN, it could take several hours for them to actually get routed through the VPN as they were supposed to. One of those was Apple's push notification service. The test that Michael Horowitz ran showed that not only did Apple's push notification service continue to route through the non-tunneled connection, but so did an Amazon connection that he was testing. And so there is a suggestion that Proton VPN had to fix this issue. And what it does is that it will allow you to kind of reset the system and make it so that you are tunneling all of your traffic through your VPN. What you do is on your device, you turn on your VPN, then you turn on airplane mode, and then you turn off airplane mode. And by doing so, it's basically breaking the connection manually and then letting that get routed through. Now, Scooter X in the chat, who shared that link, has a quote that I think does help to kind of clarify things. Quote, however, for some reason, it is off by default. It's unclear why this would be and why it seemingly hasn't been implemented by any of the VPN apps tested. And the thing that they're talking about that's off by default is the fix that Apple added in iOS 14. So what happens is, and this is the exact fix from Apple, there's a variable that a VPN developer can add to their app that's called include all networks, and then you can either choose true or false. If the value is true and the tunnel is unavailable, the system drops all network traffic, but the default value is false. So as of 2019, developers have been able to implement this setting that will then make it so that only if the traffic is all being routed through, will it work? And if it's not, then the VPN, it will. Basically, it allows the VPN to say, make sure everything is running through the VPN tunnel. So I think that despite the fact that there is a fix, it is clear that there are many VPNs that don't take advantage of this, many VPN apps that have not enabled this feature. Mm-hmm. And so if you are using a VPN on iOS and you want to be able to have a completely secure, completely VPN tunneled connection, you need to be aware of this. And you maybe need to take that step of doing the airplane mode until you can confirm with the developer of your VPN app that they have indeed enabled this feature, or that they've sort of addressed the fact that iOS can cause some issues there with proper tunneling of the VPN. So ultimately, despite the fact that Apple may have fixed this, it is kind of a glaring issue that the VPNs are still not working as one would think they would be on iOS. And so you should independently encourage your developers out there to update their apps so that they do take advantage of this.
That just kind of really surprises me that a number of VPN, you know, and not just like this just happened, the fix just happened. This was like 3 years ago, that they continually had not implemented this fix into them, because this just seems like baseline. And maybe because on Android, maybe it works differently there. I mean, I've kind of always assumed that this is what is happening when I activate a VPN, is that it immediately makes sure that all traffic going forward goes through there. That's probably an error on my part. But it sounds like, you know, this should be the way that it operates. It should absolutely, without fail, when you throw on a VPN, as the user, you expect total security. And as such, anything from that point forward, if you're getting that like confirmation on your screen that says VPN activated, that's a signal to you as the user that, great, I'm protected. My traffic is protected. But if it's not, that's a glaring omission. And I'm just kind of baffled that VPN providers wouldn't know about this. And if they did know about it, wouldn't have fixed it in the way that it needed to be fixed. It's not a very hard, you know, it's not a very difficult fix. It's a,
yeah, it looks like it is actually literally a line of code, which is not typical.
Yeah.
And there's one thing that I forgot to mention that I think is also incredibly important. And that is that there are many apps, many VPN apps that have a feature in them that says like, kill the connection if tunneling is not routed through the VPN.
Right. Yes.
And it's been the case that the security researcher tested it, and it was, despite that feature being enabled, there were still some connections happening outside of the VPN tunnel. So again, that is an issue. And I want to be clear too. I won't go as far as Michael Horowitz does in Michael Horowitz's article that says, quote, VPNs on iOS are a scam. I don't think that they're a scam. I think that there are some scam apps for sure. The VPN that I use, I know, is not a scam. But what is, you know, it's just something to be aware of and to know that this is a problem. And just if you have that awareness, then, you know, knowledge is power, and you can make that decision based on how you feel about your security and privacy. And if you want to, then go as far as to do that airplane mode feature. And in fact, I think I might ask my co-host Rosemary Orchard on iOS today if there's a shortcut that she could create that will, when I enable my VPN, automatically turn on and then turn off airplane mode to, you know, do that magical extra step that needs to happen.
So, yeah, but I also, you know, word of caution, because as I was kind of reading through some of this stuff and kind of taking a look at some of the comments in the article, some people were pointing out that sometimes the airplane mode thing doesn't actually drop previously existing connections until they've actually timed out. So if you turn off your airplane mode and then you reconnect it, sometimes those connections hop back versus turning it off and having those connections like wipe the slate clean and then come back and still just end up going through the VPN. So something to be at least aware of. Be certain that you know without fail that killing that airplane mode and then reactivating it actually does what you think it's doing. You know what I mean? Something else to be really clear about.
Michael Horowitz addresses that in the piece, talking about how airplane mode used to mean one thing on iOS and now it means another thing. And so it's possible that that doesn't, you know, work how it's intended to. So ultimately, this is one of those things where a developer needs to add this line of code so that this can be fixed, and that people who are using VPNs, who for all reasonable reasons, I guess, for all reasonable reasons, feel that they are doing what they're supposed to do and protecting themselves, only to find out later that they weren't or aren't. That's not, not great.
If you create a VPN service, I don't know why you wouldn't want this activated. I don't know that it does you a whole lot of benefit to be like, yeah, some of the traffic isn't protected by our service that is entirely designed to protect you. Yay. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm curious about that too. And I, you know, why it's an extra line of code as opposed to just being baked in by default. But yeah, if a VPN doesn't know about this fix, then that is an issue.
That surprises me. Super surprising. All right. Well, thank you for, you know, bringing that to everybody's attention. That is really interesting stuff. Know how your security tools work. That's, I think, is the moral of the story. But that is it for this episode of Tech News Weekly. We've reached the end of the show. We've had a really great show. Super appreciate all, you know, Mark Gurman, super appreciate Jay Preet for joining us and sharing their insight, and appreciate you as well. We do the show every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. So you go there, and you can find all the ways to subscribe in audio and video formats. It's just there.
If you'd like to get all of our shows ad-free, we've got a way for you to do that. It's called Club Twit. For $7 a month, you just head to twit.tv/clubtwit, and you can join the club. What does that mean? Well, along with those ad-free shows I mentioned before, literally all the shows ad-free right there in the Club Twit feed, you'll also gain access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else. That includes before the show, after the show, behind the scenes, all sorts of fun stuff that gets posted to that feed that's available exclusively to you, and access to the members-only Discord server, a place where you can go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. In fact, my co-host Rosemary Orchard from iOS Today is one of the most active people, or at least one of the most active hosts that is in the Club Twit Discord. That is, should sound good to you, I hope. twit.tv/clubtwit, $7 a month, $84 a year, and you also get access to two Club Twit shows, actually three, the Untitled Linux Show, Hands on Mac, which is my show. I'll have an episode out later today. Hands on Windows. That's the name of the other show with Paul Thurrott, where he goes hands on with Windows, offers all sorts of fun tips and tricks. My episode that's going out later today is all about privacy. Interesting. On your devices and what you can do to kind of maintain or improve the privacy you have on iOS. If you would like to follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee. That's chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. Or you can check out my shows again later today. Hands on Mac is part of Club Twit on Saturdays. The Tech Guy, the radio show heard around the world, where I and Leo Laporte answer your tech questions. And Tuesdays for iOS Today with Rosemary Orchard. Jason Howell, what about you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Jason Howell. You can find me doing All About Android here on the Twit Network, twit.tv/AAA for all Android goodness. And then, yeah, that's really about it here every week with Micah doing this awesome show, Tech News Weekly. A big thanks to John Ashley behind the scenes, and especially a big thanks to you, John, because you've over the last many weeks been doing more of the behind the scenes stuff, and I really appreciate it. You're doing a great job. So thank you, John. Thank you, Burke, for everything that you do, getting the guests ready and all the tech ready behind the scenes. And thanks to you. Yes, you, for watching and listening. We will see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, but your game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. But you already knew all that. What you may not know is that Twit now has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.